So we are in our third part of On the Giving End. We're talking about the place of giving tzedakah, the place of a Jew in society. And our topic today is Ma'aseh Ksafim Praktika. And we're going to take a look at some of the interesting aspects of giving, of tithing money. I want to first of all start off by thanking Ed and Sandy Clark. This entire series, all three parts have been sponsored by Ed and Sandy. And just as we've been passing Ed's father's first yahrzeit, Mr. David Clark, who was truly a beloved father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. We think about David Tzvi ben Yosef Yehuda, certainly during this period of time and beyond. Thank you, Ed and Sandy, for being part of this. Today's specific share, I'd like to thank Elliot and Shady Horowitz, who are sponsoring as we think about the memory of his Torah mentors who passed away in Nisan, including Rav Anon Haramati of Yeshiva Flatbush High School, which is actually Yartzai was Gimel Nissan, we just passed. Also, Mora Nechaba Leibowitz, Dr. Leibowitz, the Mora par excellence, whose Yartzai is on the 5th of Nissan, and Rav Aaron Kreisov of Yeshiva University, whose Yartzai will be this coming week. All the three who left thousands of disciples, thank you for enabling us to be exposed and to appreciate their Torah. And I want to thank Rosemary Fish, who is sponsoring today as well, in memory of her husband, Mordechai ben Eliakim Getzel, Mr. Erchi Fish, who's Shloshim we are in, Be'ezras Hashem. He should have a continued Lichter Gan Eden, Be'ezras Hashem. We're going to take a moment today, and just as the slides are coming out, to talk about a very fascinating, practical topic. This topic is an important one, and that is the idea of Ma'aser Ksafim, of tithing one's money. And one says, does the Torah really talk about tithing one's money precisely? And the truth is, not exactly. The Torah never explicitly tells us to do that. The Torah tells us a lot of other things, but it doesn't tell us about tithing of money. So as an example, one of the places where the Torah talks about this rather than tells us to do this is an example where in Parshas Lech Lecha, if you remember, there's a war between the four and the five kings. Avraham Avinu takes the side of the weaker end, which is the five kings, defends them, including the cities of the fertile valley. And when he comes to the end of that whole episode, he is approached by Malkitzedek. Malkitzedek is assumed to be Shem, who is a Kohen Le'el Elyon, is a high priest, and he says to him, Melchizedek comes over and he brings out more wine, he brings out bread, and he says the following. He says, Baruch Avraham le'el elyon konei shemayim v'aretz. Blessed is Abraham to the high God, heaven and earth. I actually just mentioned to Eliezer yesterday, I remember Rav Shechter used to point out on this pasuk, that Melchizedek was criticized for this comment. Baruch Avraham le'el elyon. Why? Because he is praising Avraham before he praises God. Right? So Rav Shechter quotes his father, who says that's why it's important when you are doing, you know, it's not appropriate that when people do a lachayim, they go this whole, you know, gans, sippur, and the whole business, and then they say, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam Sheyakol Nehiyeh Bivorecho, because they're doing what Shem did, which Malkitzedek did, which is they're putting all the human things, thank you, Marvin, all the human things before they put all the human appellations before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So he describes a story one time where he was saying this out of the Lechaim, and the person says, oh, so he goes, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Sheyakol Nehiyeh Bidvarei, says, and Lechaim, Tov, and he's like, no, you should drink first. So Malkitzedek put it the wrong way, but nonetheless, after he says that, he goes, Ubaruch El Elyon Asher Migen Sorecha Biyadecha, Vayiten Loi Ma'aser Mikol. He says to Avraham Avinu, you've had this incredible boom, right? This is a war. War can be incredibly expensive, but it can also be incredibly lucrative. And Avraham Avinu, you've now the conqueror, you're the success. So you get all these assets. So what do you need to do? Vayitin lo mi'asa mikol. Everything you've gained, you should tithe. You should give a tenth of it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what Malkitzedek says. So we see the Torah is not demanding this of us, but the Torah is describing what would be appropriate in such a situation. Similarly, when Yaakov Avinu later on is trying to escape his brother Esav, and he is fleeing in Parshas Vayetze from Esav. He arrives at this makom, this place, where this place is. He goes to sleep. He doesn't really know what it is. And in the dream, he hears HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this whole the ladder, the angels, the whole business. And then he wakes up in the morning and he says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Vayidar Yaakov Neder Leimor, Im Yeh Elokim Mimodzi, if God's going to be with me, Shmarani baderech hazeh asher anerchi aleich, v'nosani lechem le'echo ve'begel le'ilbosh, and I'm going to have the wherewithal to do everything I need, then, and I'm going to return to, in peace to my father's house, because remember, he's leaving Israel to go to the Syria area. He says, and I'm going to make this make an altar over here, v'kol asher titeni aser asrenu loch. Everything that you give me, I will tithe. If you remember, Yaakov leaves in a state of destitution, he has nothing to his name, comes back and he's quite a successful businessman, and this is the debt we see played later on if we go back to fast forward to Parshas Vayishlach. So when Yaakov comes back 20 years later, he does make good on this promise as well. Again, you'll notice something interesting, that neither of these are prescriptive, these are both descriptive. So the Torah is describing a story that we know well, and is describing that people upon success will give a tithe of their assets. Notice an interesting aspect of this is that if you contrast the stories, that Avram is being asked to give his tithe when he's successful. Yaakov is promising his tithe when he's not successful. He's in a state of need. It's worthwhile noting that perhaps the Torah is focusing on the fact that there's times we need to give when it's success, and there's times we need to give when we're hoping for success, but we're very much far away from it. I think we can identify with being in both of those places. It's important to acknowledge and to give at both of those places and stages. It always reminds me of when you read the Haftorah on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, we hear about Chana. Chana was her currency was not money, but her currency was being able to build a family. That was what was important to her. And we hear the word Vatispalel Chana twice. One time she davens at such a stage when she's desperate to have a child, that's in Perek Aleph. And then when she has the child of her dreams, Shmuel, then it says Vatispalel Chana, she prays again, and that's the song of Chana. And it's interesting to put the two together, that at the low and the moment of desperation is when she prays, and the high and the moment of resolution is where she prays as well. It's worthwhile thinking about in terms of sort of the different places in life. And I think if you look at the Yaakov and Avraham Avinu models of it, we have this. So where does this apply itself? So it turns out that you don't find the Torah ever describing that a person should give a tenth of their assets. We do hear the Sifrei, which is the Medrash Halacha, does just say this. It does comment in a derech drush, which means deriving out of the psukim, that one should be doing this. But where does it come from? Where does this notion of a tenth of one's assets comes from? So the most basic idea would be there's two models we can look at. The first we can look at is what's called maaser ani. So it's just important to remember, if you remember sort of the stages of the, we'll call it the Hebrew year system, right? So everything's built in cycles of seven. The days are built in cycles of seven, and the years are built in cycles of seven. This is a quick recap of how this works. On an average year, if you're a farmer, which most people in Israel were, if you go back to, if anybody just been to Ir David recently, just in the last year or so? No? Okay, fantastic. If not, you should. The next time you go to Israel, you really should book a tour of Ir David. It's fantastic. It's always new, and if you haven't been there beforehand, it's remarkable. One of the things that you realize is that what we call the old city of Jerusalem is really the new city, right? All the walls and that's all Muslim. that's recent. That's like the 600s. I mean, like, really. You know, so when you talk about the old city of Jerusalem is down the hill. That's where Jerusalem was. The addendum at the top of the hill where the old city is today, the old city of Jerusalem, that's all the new stuff. Right, that's where the Beis Hamikdash was, the extension of the Beis Hamikdash into all the quarters, that was the overflow. Jerusalem was down the hill. If you go down to the Kidron Valley, you look out the Shaar HaShemot, you look down to Ir David, that what will be called Silwan today, that's where Jerusalem was, right? And if you measure the space of where the Jerusalem was, it's not very big. And one of the reasons the tour guide explained is because, most of the people didn't live in the city. Most of the people lived in the farms around. The city may have been the option when a host came, a war host came, and everybody had to congregate in the city. But the city was not so large at all. Most people were farmers, and so therefore this system was something which was natural to anybody who had a pitchfork in their hand. So what was the system? Let's quickly remind ourselves. What happens is that the planting season is when? When does everything happen? If anybody needs sources, there are coming around. Thank you so much, Marvin. If anybody needs anybody needs to have some extras over here. Thank you so much. So let's sort of put ourselves into the agricultural cycle. When are you planting as a farmer? You're planting right after Sukkot. Remember, Sukkot was the end of the good year. You start planting. The rainy season starts right after Sukkot. You start tending the crops. You start looking after everything. And throughout the winter, which is the rainy season, that's where you're tending, growing, plowing, all of that. Let's not talk about the orchards right now. Let's just talk about the grain products. And when are we starting to see our grains peaking out? Right around now. As we move towards Pesach, that's when the barley starts rising. As we move towards Shavuos, that's when the wheat starts rising. That's the end of the cycle, and we start harvesting and gathering. So now let's say we're coming towards the spring. The rains are coming to their end. The harvest is coming to its full fruition. We now harvest. So what happens? So the first thing that we do as a regular average farmer is we need to give truma. How much of one's, let's say we have 100 units of 100 units of grain that we brought into the storehouse. How much of that is going to truma, which goes to the Kohanim Society? So one in 50, which is 2%. Okay, so 2% go to the Kohanim. Then after that, now we're looking at our sort of our tax deduction here for our Israelite Agricultural Society. So we've now declared taxes on 2%. What's next? Next is we call Maaser, right? Maaser goes to the Levi. Now, why do the Levi get so much more? Like, it's unfair. 10% is much more than 2% because they're more Levi. Good. just numbers, folks. Right, they're more Levi'im, so they happen to need more. So there would be next 10% goes to Levi'im. Good. So now at this point in time, we're talking about 12% of one's crops is already out. This is excluding all the stuff left behind, like the peah and the lekah and the shikha, all the, we'll call the ancillary stuff, which is poor property, the property of the poor. But let's say what we're actually bringing into the grain house, which is we'll call declared income. So now,
12% or 10% of the
menu? Good question. Good question. Do you take, is it 10% of the remainder? I don't remember offhand. If it's that.
9.8%.
No, what was that?
About
9.8%. There we go. If you actually take a look at the population, it's interesting to do this. It actually comes out flash in terms of the Levi'im and the Kohanim. Certainly the times of the Bais Rishon. If you do the countings and then back to the time of Ezra again as well, it's a little more complex. But be it as it may, then the next thing we do is at this point in time you think you're scot-free, but not quite, because on an average year, then you need to take another 10%. But the good news about this next 10% is that it's yours, really. This is what's called Ma'aser Sheni, second tithe. You think, my goodness, what is the Torah asking of us? The Torah asks us to take that 10% and use it in Jerusalem. So if it's fruits, if it's grain, we have to consume that in Jerusalem. If one's not able to do that, one takes off its kedusha onto the money. The money has to be spent in Jerusalem as well, so that one's forced to pilgrimage. One is forced to experience this in Yerushalayim. There's a certain world called spiritual gravitational center in Jerusalem, which is forcing the regular farmer to leave their homestead to Jerusalem, and that's what happens in years essentially 1, 2, 4, and 5. Okay, so out of the 7-year cycle, 4 of those years, that's what happens. However, in years 3 and 6, something else happens, and that is that the second tithe goes to the poor, which means if you think about it in terms of just sort of cycles, it really is the Hebrew system is 3 years, 3 years, 1 year. 3 years, 3 years, 1 year. So the Shiva cycle is not a 7-year cycle. It's 2 threes added together. So it goes, Maaser Sheni, Maaser Sheni, Maaser Ani, Maaser Sheni, Maaser Sheni, Maaser Ani. Okay, that's the way it works. So essentially every 3 years, a tenth of my crops are going to the poor for distribution, which is why Biur Maestros, which is when one, so to speak, cleans out back taxes, happens every, right? So one does the cycle of end of 3 years, essentially, right? Which is the capstone of that cycle as well. Okay, Biur Zamei. So this is a model that we can talk about, and this was talked about in Halacha. The Rambam describes this idea of Maaser Ani, which happens every 3 years, and he says, and this is the page which says Maaser Ani. He says the following: Ala Seder Azem Afrishin B'Shana Harishon Amin Hashavua U'V'Shenis V'Revius L'Chamishis. Maaser Sheni happens in 2, 1, 2, 3, and 4 and 5. Aval V'Shlishis U'V'Shishis in the 3rd and the 6th year of the cycle. You have another tithe. You give this to the poor. There's no maaser. You're not going up to Jerusalem this year. It's just the tithe for the poor. And so this is what happens every 3 years. Now this is we'll call it model number one, which we can look at. Notice that there's a number of limitations in this model, because if this is the model that we're going to use for money, notice this is all about crops, right? If this is for money, then first of all, would it follow that pattern, which is once every 3 years? You know, like, so that it's not a hard and fast rule which would apply itself naturally to our, we'll call it, society, which is not agrarian particularly. That's question number one. And then also there are limitations as to where one can give maaser ani. One has to give it to poor people. One can't give it to certain other things, like mitzvahs, as an example. You can't double dip your deductions. Right, so one would have to sort of wonder, is this the model we're using? The other model, of course, is tzedakah. Right, so we have a responsibility to give tzedakah, and this mitzvah is across society. Every person in society is required, the poorest of the poor and the richest of the rich are required to give tzedakah. We have a minimum. The minimum is a shlish of a shekel, which is nothing. And then the maximum is a person shouldn't give more than 20% of their assets. So there's a bracket, and that depends on need, depends on circumstance, depends on the constellation of those around one, whether it's one's family, whether it's one's neighbors as well. The question is, where does Ma'aser Kesafim fit into? Because it really is neither of those, right? It's not a tithing of money or one's proceeds is not like the what one finds in the field, and not what one finds in stocker, which is sort of more amorphous in terms of the chiyuv. So there happens to be a debate in the Mefarshim as to how how obligatory this is at all. So as an example, the Bach Rav Yoel Sirkis, in his commentary on Shulchan Aruch, makes the following observation, and he says that he doesn't believe that this is a mitzvah asay min haTorah. He doesn't believe it's a mitzvah midrabon either. It's a nice practice. It's a good minag. It's a quantifiable way of doing what's right. But it's not necessarily what the Torah prescribes, nor the rabbis prescribe, which is why you don't see it talked about more explicitly as well. His son-in-law, who was the Taz, disagrees and feels that it is really obligatory as an extension of Ma'aser Kesafim, as Ma'aser Ani, as what would be going on in the field. Generally today, the predominant view among most poskim is it is not obligatory. It's something that one opts into. It's much easier to do something when it's quantifiable. So we have to give tzedakah. All of us have to give tzedakah, no matter who we are, where we are. Then how do you give tzedakah? What are the rules and how much? So the best, well, not best, it's called midah benonis, actually. It's not the best, but we'll call it average giving is meant to be 10% of our assets. That says a lot, folks. I asked our financial planner, out of all the Jews that you consult, how many people are doing this? He's like, not so many. it's not so easy to do because it's the requirement. But however, there are a few things that are important to be aware of as well. So depending on where the model is drawn from, whether the model is the model of tzedakah or the model is the Ma'aser Ani model, there are one or two just interesting nafkei mina, which means to say differences in application as well. So, for instance, so there is a concept in Ma'aser Ani which is called testing Hashem, right? Which means to say, generally speaking, we're not allowed to test God. You're not supposed to say, God, if I do this and you do that, and right, so that's not the way we were meant to barter with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. However, when it comes to Ma'aser, we can. The Torah tells us, "Ubechanuni na bazeh." HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, "You can test me. How in Ma'aser? If you give Ma'aser, I'll bishul shishetis asher." That there's a play on words. If you give Ma'aser, the word asar, which is the word for tithing, that's where Ma'aser comes from the same word as ashirut, which is wealth. If you give Ma'aser, you will be blessed with riches. That's what the Torah says explicitly. This is in Nevi'im. And that being the case, you're not allowed to do it with any other place or domain in Halacha. The question is, if Ma'aser Kesafim is in the same realm, you may be entitled to say such a thing. And many poskim suggest that maybe this could be transferable to us as well. Sorry, yeah.
Is it 10% of income?
We'll say again in a second.
Assets?
We'll get that in a second. Okay, so let's this is begadol. Let's get down to specifics in a second, because we can discuss what's deductible, what's not. Is it capital? Is it profits? We'll get that in a second. So we'll deal with some of the details right now. I want to thank Yosef for many questions on this topic. So we're gonna push into this in just a moment as well. Let's go into the what it's taken from. Okay, so let's go straight into what do we take Maaser Kesafim from as well. By the way, so let's say another enough given, by the way, is if you're not able to afford it, let's say you do not have, you know, let's say you have a business and there's a certain amount of expenditure every month, and this month there wasn't profit, right? Is there a requirement to give or not? So if it's Maaser, if it's followed based on the Maaser model, you wouldn't be chayev. You only chayev when there's profit, right? So, but if it's stocker, you would be chayev. So generally speaking, we generally view it more like the Maaser model, which means to say that we can, so to speak, expect or anticipate of Hashem, if we do this properly, to be replenished. And we do assume that that if a person is not making profit, there's no Maaser requirement, but there still is a stocker requirement, but that's minimal as a whole. One does not need to digging into capital or into one's wallet for this as well. Let's take a look at some basic examples. So, where does it come from? So, it is interesting that the Chafetz Chaim wrote many svarim. Most people know the Chafetz Chaim and Shmiras Halashim, but they're not aware of the fact that he wrote an abundance of other svarim. One very important one, which most people have not studied, is called Avas Chesed. It's the halachas of all kinds of kindness to others. In the second chelik, he spends four chapters talking about tzedakah, and it's really worthwhile reading. It's very easy, it's very accessible today, it's a very beautiful print. And he describes, he's even got a yomi cycle today, right? Like the Chafetz Chaim's got the cycle of every 3 months, this Avas Chesed is the same thing. And he points out that for the first time that one gives, one should be doing it on all one's assets. However, there afterwards, it should be on profits, which means that one should take a moment and say, I'm going to say, however much is to my name, a tenth, boom. And there afterwards, one takes profits that goes on. He says, for some people, it's very difficult to do that, because if they sort of wake up to the game at a certain point, you know how complicated it is filing tax returns. This becomes very, very complicated. So he says it may be difficult for a person to do that. So the Chavetz Chaim's suggestion, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, says, acknowledging this, and certainly today we have much money nested in all kinds of different things, he says, create a fund which is meant to be for loans for the poor, based on the capital. Which means to say, if one works out one sum total and one hasn't given a Maaser Sheni, this is why it's better to start this practice earlier in life, when there's much less to your name. let's say one hasn't done that, and one needs to do this, and it's very hard to give that amount of money away, use that money for the, we'll call it the assets, on as a loan gemach, or something which you still maintain, but is considered giving as well. Then, as one gets in new revach, when one gets a new profit, that should be taxable to my six of him as well. That's the way he suggests setting it up. Now the question becomes is what about tax, right? So where does tax money focus a feature in this process as well? So when it comes to income tax is not considered profit, right? So meaning to say, we don't look at gross, we look at net, and so that's a significant difference, because it's not considered as if you earned the income tax and you gave it away. You never got it, right? It's being deducted as you go. You never see that, and so it is no longer, it's not considered part of the cheshbon of that. So essentially, we're looking at, depending on what bracket one's in, you know, we're talking about, you know, really 70% of one's salary, or depending on how the state and federal tax systems are working as well. When it comes to other types of taxes, you do need to include it. So for instance, property tax is not considered a deduction, right? So property tax is, you don't say, well, I'm paying X amount of property tax depending on which district I'm in, and that's considered an expenditure, right? So that you have to include that, you start to include pre-tax, the amount that one's giving on Maaser Kesafim. Similarly, sales tax, which of course, you know, it's harder to do the cheshbon as well. And what about now deducted money for charity? This is where the two systems do not converge. So let's say I decide I'm going to allocate, you know, X amount of money per year to tzedakah, right? To charities. Sorry, let's just say to charities. And the government is very kind to me and gives me a kickback by making it tax deductible. So now I file my taxes and I say now I give an X amount to charity, and that now is non-taxable income for me, which is fantastic, right? So I get this kickback of saving taxes on that. So the truth is that that's not deductible for my sukkahfim. Meaning, well, I can't say that the money saved on those taxes, so this makes it a little more complicated to do the cheshbon, well, I can't say the money saved on taxes there is scot-free. That really is money which one should be considering in terms of the my sukkahfim table as well. Just in terms of the taxes as well. What about inheritance? So any type of person comes across good money, which is, hopefully under good circumstances, but let's say there's a large gift or a person receives an inheritance, the first thing one would want to do, and this is the easier time to do it, is when one feels that sense of benevolence and gratitude, that's the moment to say, okay, quickly, let's put 10% of that into a different account before I start thinking it's mine, and allocate, just to put itself in a different place. That's much easier than the bigger, you know, all my assets. This is, as anything comes in, as anything special comes in, make sure to go to put in 10% elsewhere. Now, there happens to be in halacha, there's a lot that's talked about in terms of business expenditure. This is very important. So actually, there's a sefer which I found was very helpful, and this is called Sharei Torah Sabayis. And I just want to do a quick summary of some of the rules that he mentions when it comes to this. So anything which is business related is you do not need to contribute towards my sukkahfim. So what does that mean? That means to say that, let's say I'm a business owner. Okay, so I'm not talking about an employee right now. But let's say I'm a business owner. So I have an incredible amount of expenses, right? I have to pay the rent, I have to pay insurance, I have to pay building taxes, I have to pay all these things related to floating a company. Now, hopefully, if it's a successful company, then the profits are going to far exceed everything I'm spending, and hopefully not too long far down the road. But all those expenses are not considered taxable to my sukkahfim, right? That's employee salaries, employee benefits, all those things that I'm paying. Of course, that's not considered profit, so therefore it would not be under the rubric of my sukkahfim. And that would go so far as to include, this does apply to employees now, is, let's say, the cost of travel. Right, so let's say one is an employee, not a business owner, and one has to rent a car, or one has to pay tolls, or one has to take business trips, and so on, and it has to come off one's own bat. That's not considered that's considered business expenditures. Business expenditures is not part of the my sukkahfim business. So much so that let's say you have, as is very much the common practice, the necessary practice today, is to have a two-family income house. It's almost impossible to survive on one income these days. So let's say you have a dual family income, but there's young children. Right, so if both the parents are at the house, and therefore there is a need to pay for a babysitter, right, or let's say a housekeeper, because if one of the parents was home, that would have been their job. But this is also considered business expenditure, right? And we're talking about significant money. We're talking about $30,000-$40,000 a year when it comes down to these things. That is not, that's called a business expenditure, not and therefore not a household expense. All household expenses are taxable in my sukkahfim, but business expenditures are not. One has to be honest with oneself in terms of like sort of just working out where the constellation is of these things. Included the things that one cannot deduct. These are things which one has to. These are post my sukkahfim, are household expenses, house taxes, life insurance, medical insurance, savings, right? Supporting children. These are things which are not considered business expenses. These are basic expenses. So you have to give my sukkahfim before you start this. This is in terms of the system of how it's set up. Now the question is to what is one supposed to give? And I just want to stop here as well, because this is a lot to swallow. this is a lot of things. And I once spoke to Raoul Willig about this, and I said, like, what happens if you're on the spectrum of giving, and you're like, I really want to do more, but I'm not there yet, right? I'm sort of not there. Is there a value? You know, I'm in the 3% zone, I'm in the 4% zone, I'm in the 5% zone. Is there a value of that? And he said, absolutely. Meaning to say, being as we paskin today, this is not a chiyuv gamur. This is not what every person has to be doing. This is the place. This is where we should be at. This is where we should be getting to. We'll call it an aspirational movement towards. One should be moving upwards along this, and as one is more successful, one should be trying to ratchet up to, in order to be able to get closer to this as well. So it's not an all or nothing scale. It's really important to remember. Sometimes we dismiss this and we say this is way too much to be thinking about. One should be getting there. If you speak to Rav Shechter, I remember Rav Shechter when he talks about this. He talks about the young families which are not really making it yet. You know, they're sort of just on a shoelace. He says, so cheshbon out. They can't be giving yet. He says, keep a log, and God willing, when you're very successful, all the minimal amounts that you couldn't do when you're young, you do later on when hopefully things are more successful. But remember that this is not an all or nothing. This is something which is aspirational. It's also important to remember, and just as we talked about beforehand, is that charity giving is not the same as ma'asik sofim necessarily, right? So there's 501c3s which are not tzedakah, right? So sorry, you're talking about let's say every official hall is a wonderful thing, but it's not tzedakah, right? On the one hand, and giving tzedakah may supersede and be much larger than one's charity giving, because there may be not a, we'll call it a financial kickback in the American system of giving, but that's still requirement in tzedakah as well. And the tzedakah requirements are much larger and more quantified than the charity giving. Yes?
So how intuition?
Good, okay, let's get that in a second. So let's say, this, all we talked about right now, this first section over here, was really from where does it come, right? So meaning, is it taxable, not taxable, what's included, business expenses, personal expenses, and so on. Let's now go to where can it be given. That's the next section. So the next section over here is where does it go to? So the primary recipient, actually, says the Avas Chesed, that's again, that is the Chofetz Chaim, he says, is poor people. Really, it should be going to poor people. Now, notice, by the way, that a lot of our charity, if you think about a lot of our charity giving, there's a lot that does go to poor people, but there's a lot that doesn't go to poor people as well. So, you can think of very wonderful organizations which are doing medical research, organizations which are support for people who have diseases, God forbid. And those are wonderful things, but it's not necessarily, that's not to poor people, right? Now, it's a big myth and it's wonderful, but the Ma'asek Sofim piece of this might be specifically more those who are struggling. The Chofetz Chaim says, and if there are those who are struggling, who are living a Torah lifestyle and supporting Torah lifestyle as well, that seems to be the primary space for Ma'asek Sofim itself as well. Now, one may have to be flexible if one says, I only have so much to give, and I need to diversify around the things that matter to me because of the circumstances I'm in and the family that I'm in and the people I know. One may have to diversify, but primarily it's meant to be to those who are poor, right? Because it's patterned off that the shadow in the background is Ma'aser Ani, and that was meant to be for poor people, not wonderful things and schemes and NGOs about water in Africa. Those are great, but the point is that there are the poor people who need to receive this as well. Let's talk about a few examples which are important. So, what about family? Right. So we learned a little 2 weeks ago that family should be the prime beneficiary, meaning the first requirement of tzedakah is always family. So that means to say that, let's say, one's parents, one's relatives, are in a state of need, one, the primary beneficiary, in fact, that's called tzedakah, one should be giving to one's family. But that the exception to that is one's children. Because if one's children are in one's house, and one's meant to be looking after them, then the giving them is called parenting, not tzedakah, right? That's the basic premise of having children. If anyone remembers, just to guess this guy coming to dinner, do you remember the 1969 video, Sidney Poitier, the young Sidney Poitier? If you remember this, there was this heated debate between himself and his father, and he was dating a girl who was going to marry who his father highly disapproved of because she was white, and Sidney Poitier was colored, and it was this terrible debate that was going on, and the dad says what? And he was a doctor, yeah, he was fantastic. Anyway, so he says his dad was talking to him, and he said, son. His father was a mailman. He says, I carried that mail bag through the thick and the thin and through the cold, and your mother sacrificed her winter coat so we could give you an education, and now you're doing this to us? He responded, and he said, Dad, he said, even if you carry that mail bag a million miles, he says, that's what you needed to do, because that's the responsibility of a father bringing a child into this world. And I was, anyway, so I always reflect on that scene, and I remember that they were actually saying each other's lines. The son should be saying, "Dad, I respect you because of everything you did to me." And the father should say, "Son, I needed to do everything I did." That's really how the voices were exchanged, but that's usually how we have our fights. We focus on what we're entitled to rather than our responsibilities. But be it as it may, so children are a requirement. The question is, what age? Is there, like, can you bracket that? Where's the stage? So any guesses in halacha where that age is put in the perspective? Yeah.
Is it at 6?
Yes, sorry, you're awesome. So it's true. The halacha is actually, if you read the sources, is 6 years old. Now, folks, we're not talking about today's society. Just to appreciate this. Rav Moshe Feinstein in a tshuva talks about this. Why? Because if you think about it, in those days where there wasn't really much of a school system, what would happen is children would start working. They would start taking internships and work studies, is what we call them today, and they'd start earning their money and start contributing to the pot. And in many senses, the family depended on all the children being involved, right, from a pretty early age. And so that was considered the age of independence. Today, 37 maybe. Yes. There was a great video which was called Millennials, right? And says, I was talking about the millennial who dreams of being a millionaire at the age of 29. He says, "Well, get off your yoga pants and start working." And so it's very hard today. Things have changed a little bit. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says it depends on the cultural norms of society. And today, to a large degree, it's around marriage time, right? So parents usually support their children till marriage. And today, if you look at the trends with the age that a lot of kids are getting married, not even then, right? So if it's the stage where, so to speak, to independence, that becomes the responsibility of parents. That's not stalker. However, let's say that you've done your job, Baruch Hashem, your kids are independent now, and they're no longer supposed to be part of your household. They're doing their thing. They're working. They're looking after themselves. Then, actually, the first round of people who need to receive are family as well. And this is not as exciting, and it's not as, because one's not getting one's name onto a building for this as well. But in the end of the day, that's actually where it starts. So it's more important to do this. And part of the logic of this, as we learned a little bit last time, was that the expectation is such in society. Meaning, when somebody looks in and they say, "Oh, X is really clearly having a difficult time, but their brother is, their sister is, their parents are," that society looks in and says, "Oh, they're probably being taken care of." And the part of that expectation is part of the responsibility as well, which is why the pasuk builds in it. It starts with the first word is achicha, your brother, meaning it starts off with the family. So the family is part of this, and it goes to the stage that a person is responsible. What about tuition? So this is a very important one. And tuition is not deductible for tax for Maasek Safim. It may be for we won't get into the legal system, but in terms of Maasek Safim, the reason is because that's your responsibility. You have to pay for your children's education. Yes.
What about for a grandchild?
Ah, excellent. And this would be fine for Maasek Safim, because in this case one is helping. Again, this is the example of a family which is independent, right? So they're now earning their three salaries, right? And they're still not making it, and they still can't make it. Contributing towards that is certainly can be from the Maasek Safim. It's the primary experience of tzedakah as well. It's not your chiyuv. That's the point. When it's your chiyuv, then you can't say, "I'm going to double dip my chiyuv with Maasek Safim." So I have to educate my children, and I also have to give Maasek Safim. I'm going to use the two together. That doesn't work for you.
Yeah, but even if you look at tuition, let's say the yeshiva has a budget of, let's say, $1 million, and if it was evenly distributed amongst all the families in the school, your tuition would be, let's say, $10,000. But since there are many people in the school who can't afford the tuition, so they make the tuition $20,000 and people have scholarship. So is that,
That's a good question. That's a question in general for tax purposes that everyone wants the schools to disclose, and the schools are less willing to disclose because what's the actual cost of education? I want you to know just as a fun fact. What's the cost of educating Mary can speak to this better. What's the average cost of educating a high school student in New York State?
$37,000.
Yeah, they're actually around there. Mary is
close to 40.
Okay, so close to 40. Now, just to appreciate that. So I just want to appreciate that for a second. What that means is that we have a dual curriculums in our school. That means to say we have double amount of teachers, right? And the days are longer, and we pay them, and the tuition is half of that. Now it's backbreaking, but just to appreciate the cost. Now, The truth is that in the public school system, a lot goes to benefits, and there's a lot more that the teachers are actually getting, as opposed to where the teachers are really not getting much out of the, in the Jewish day schools at all. But be it as it may, just to understand that the Jewish day schools have very smart people working really hard to do very much with very little. So they are always operating on deficit in terms of what they're doing. But yes, technically speaking, so Paul, your question as well. It's hard to know because the school. It's not like the schools are, you know, lucrative and flush in cash flow. A lot of schools are still going paycheck to paycheck. They don't have direct deposits. Local schools, because there are cash flow issues. And so that means to say that even though we may say, well, technically speaking, it costs X, Y, Z for a student, the school needs to float. So it becomes harder to do this. When I spoke to Rav Willig, Rav Willig did make an interesting point, and that is that. If, let's say, a particular parents come into the school and they're afforded a certain amount of tuition assistance, which many, many, many families do, right? So, and then they want to give extra because they come upon extra, right? And they feel the responsibility to the school because they feel badly that they can't do what they can, which is a lot of people do in that space. That's certainly the extra, certainly is my success. I mean, to say, well, the school, let's say the school gives you an X amount and I have X plus this year and I want to give a little extra. That would certainly be my success. That's because it's beyond what the school's determined my fiscal responsibility is in this case. Yeah, Elliot.
What about the priority of payment of debts that we're getting stuck on? And in that context, when you send your kid to the school, you're incurring a debt. So if I have the choice now of paying my tuition or paying a debt that I owe to somebody or giving stuck and pushing off that debt, what's the priority?
If a person's not making profits, I mean, you say if a person, if one's going into debt, right, then one can question whether the Maasek Sofim is applicable in that particular family's situation. I would imagine so, yeah. I would imagine so. If that's the case, and which is a lot of the schools who demand a credit card and say it doesn't matter where it's coming from. If you have to pay it back in 20 years' time, yeah. So I would certainly say so. In terms of that family, yes. In terms of that family, that's not my success, and that's just surviving, rather. Right. So if a person's not into survival, then one would have to pay one's debt. But it's not that would not be my success. One would be, so to speak, alleviated of the my success in such a situation if one is going into debt. But that's not like saying I'm paying the my success.
That apply also to repayment of loans, for instance. Mm-hmm. Just about everybody has a mortgage on the house. And they're repaying monthly on that loan.
No. I don't believe so, because that is considered a basic expenditure. Meaning, as opposed to I should have paid for the house in one lot, I can't, so I'm paying for it on a monthly basis, or at least most of it's going to the interest.
But I have X amount of dollars, and my choice is paying my loan or giving stock on me. Don't I take that? I don't have the money. It's a choice, and I've got to pay
correct.
The loan first.
So if one doesn't have the money, one can't give that stock up. We're talking about a situation where there is. Right? We talk about a situation where a person does have, and the question is I'd like to double dip, and I'd like to say, rather than giving stock up to a group of poor people or organizations, I would like to give to the school, because that sort of that now takes away my responsibility, and certainly with the tuition costs today, it'll take away most of my responsibility just by paying the schools as a parent. In that case, that's the suggestion. When there is no money to be had, then there's no MISO to be given.
In effect, you are netting out your expenses.
Correct. There's nothing left. There's nothing left to give. But again, one has to ask one question. So, like, let's say when it comes to, you know, so how far does this go? Just to push the envelope a little bit, Elliot, on your point. Let's say, does that mean to say that a person should, and these are painful questions, like, what about vacations then, you know? So should one say that, okay, so in order to give master, I shouldn't go on vacation? These are the questions that school committees have to deal with when it comes to these things. And the truth is that there are certain basic things. Going on a vacation with one's family is a basic necessity. Is a basic necessity today. Going away for Pesach or to Hawaii in the winter break is not. But to go on a vacation, you go take a road trip up to Acadia. You go drive out and you go do local vacations. That's basic necessity, right? So there has to be balance within these things as well. And this is a lot of the questions. Are you interested? Actually, there was a great podcast where Steve Savitsky interviewed Richie Hagler. It's really worthwhile listening to. just to listen to some of the complexities of these questions on the school side of things. But in terms of the Maasek Sofim Shiboy, when I spoke to Rav Willig about this, he says it's within reason, meaning to say there's certain basic things that family needs, but extravagance is not necessary. It's just hard because sometimes when you live among extravagance, then a lot of people who can't afford it feel that they need to afford it, and that should have been money that wasn't necessarily given. Now, what about this is a complicated one. What about shul dues? So in terms of deduction, that is there is a deduction, right? That's a 501c3. That's fantastic. What about my six of him? Can I write that off as my six of him as well? And listen to this, folks. Okay, hold your breath. It says the Ma'aril, commenting 700 years ago, says, says that's not appropriate to give shul dues because it's meant to be going to poor people, not to upholding the community. An understanding of what this is you are mechuyav in that anyway. As part of a community, you have to support your local communal institutions. It's not like a nice thing to do. It's a have to. And therefore, the Maaser is, you can't say, well, I'm going to pay what I have to, and give it to and say this is my being magnanimous and giving my sex off, and those are two separate entities. Now, what was that? that's true. So I would imagine again the communal structure in those days was more simple, where there was one community, one school, and so on. So that would be it. But in today's day and age, Baruch Hashem, where we're able to support many, I believe that would certainly be called being charitable. But in a similar way, the question is, what about acts of mitzvahs? So as an example, the Shach talks about, I'm trying to see where this is in the sources here. I don't have pages, this is all meant to be a slideshow here. I don't know the pages here. Thank you. Oh, here we go. So items of mitzvah, the Shach says, "Ein nasas ma'aser shelo." He quotes the Marashal Vadrisha Kosu, Vishem Chuvas Maram, the Cholmitsa Shatovali Yodoka going Lios Bal Bris, or the Hachnis Chasan Vakala Lachupa, the Kiagavna, the Hain Liknois Svarim Nilmod Bohem, or the Shilam Lacherim Nilmod Bohem, him Loihoyo Yacholis Biodoi, the Loihoyo Isaosa Mitsa Yachol Liknois Mina Maser. So let's say I encounter a mitzvah. There's somebody getting married that I'd like to help. There's a Takana wedding that I'm trying to do. There's a buying Svarim. They're doing things which is a mitzvah. And if I were not, and let's say now we've passed the debt, right? So I've paid my mortgage, my monthly mortgage. I've paid my monthly tuition dues, right? And I have a little bit of extra money, and I can give this to my six of him. Can I use this now for that, right? So he says, if there would be no alternative, meaning to say there's only so much money left in the pot, and now there's this mitzvah opportunity coming my way, I can spend it on that. However, obviously, he's saying if it's a mitzvah, then it would be better to have two separate pots. One's for the Maaser, the Maaser Ksafim, and one is for the mitzvah which comes to me. I should try to differentiate if I have the financial wherewithal to do that. Which comes down to, I think, the way it works, actually, when I was speaking to Rav Willig about shul dues as well. If a person has only X amount of money left, and one wants to figure out where it's going, and one doesn't have the ability to do shul dues, and these particular mitzvah projects which come across one's path, one can use one's Maaser Ksafim for this. But if there is more space, one's more latitude, one should be doing it in the space where there isn't an already existing mitzvah. One should not be doing this in an existing mitzvah, which comes down to a question which comes up a lot of times, and that is what about using my Maaser this year to write a Sefer Torah? This comes up a lot as well. So can I sort of, and that's because it's a big chunk of money, and I'm owing this amount of money this year, so it would be nice to do this, and that will come down to the way that the Shach Paskins over here, which is that if I have no ability to do it elsewise, and this is my mitzvah, then okay. But if one does have the ability to, it's not appropriate. Let's say I have my six of him account, and I'd like to write a Sefer Torah. It's incumbent upon everybody to write a Sefer Torah in their life if they're able to. That's why it would be better not to double dip if there's an alternative. So it may depend circumstantially on the person themselves as well. And finally, let's take a look at we looked at tuition. What else do we have over here in this section? Oh, the when. So how do you do this? Like how often is this? You know, everybody's different when it comes to, you know, like if you look at the way people pay taxes, you know, like how late do they leave it and how much do they gather their documents and you know, how does this work exactly? So the Chavetz Chaim, when describing this, says that the best way to do it is, technically speaking, is based on every prophet. So he says, this is in Avas Chesed chapter 18, V'nei kol zetov im yesh lo esek prati shiyuchol lichtov arevach shemazmin lo Hashem b'chol pam. If you can really come in as the prophet comes in, I'm allocating it to a separate account. That's the best thing to do. But if you're dealing with millions of sales, so you need to do an annual accounting as to what is necessary, and then you figure out what's the profit margin. What the profit margin is, I'm going to put elsewhere. Now that's when you're dealing with a person who's in the store, right? By the way, Chofetz Chaim was a store owner, right? So that's how he made his money as was necessary. So you take a log at the end of the year and you figure out what it is. An easier etzah today, certainly for people who are salaried, is as it's coming in, one cheshbon's how much one's going to be getting per year. And how much one has, and the best thing to do is, as it comes in, have a monthly account which goes to one's stock account, and that money goes there independently of one putting it there. And then when one has various solicitations or needs that come one's way, one says, how much do I have in my budget this month, right? Because I've already put the money there as well. When it comes to the distribution aspect of it, the Chofetz Chaim takes it one step further, and he says, well, how much should I be distributing? He has an interesting rule, which I'm not sure everybody does, is in the next page in the distributing, he says, I'll tell you a way that you should do this consistently. You should have money which is always set aside for this, meaning you should always have money in the bank to give as is needed. So it should not be so difficult on a person. So again, we should have a consistent influx into that tzedakah account. Person should always try to bring down at least 2/3 of it being emptied out on a consistent basis to those who need. There's always people in need. There's always people soliciting and in need. And you should keep 1/3 of it. So 33% should be sort of saved up for the more significant projects that one is perhaps waiting for. Now, again, this may be different for different people because, again, there's some people who are visionaries and they're saying, I want to build something which is going to change the lives of millions of people, not just the individual solicitors. So in that case, one's sort of moving towards a much bigger project. That's fine as well. But if on an average basis, on an average day-to-day, week-by-week basis, on a regular person, it's appropriate to make sure that one's flushing through that he would say up to 2/3, and allowing 1/3 for special and rainy days where one needs to build up towards bigger projects as well. That's the way the Chofetz Chaim suggested. Again, the Chofetz Chaim is not dealing with the salary brackets that perhaps we're dealing with in Eastern Europe. It was more complex. It was very much hand to mouth. It was much more simple living style. So maybe slightly different today when it comes to visionary. He makes 5 recommendations which are worthwhile doing, and he says that when one gives ma'aseh k'sofim, when anyone does anything which is good, one should be careful to say bli neder when one starts doing good things. Okay, because when one gets into a good practice, if you do it 3 times, it becomes like a neder. And that becomes a self-imposed responsibility. So whenever one does these kind of things, one should say, I'm doing this bli neder, because in case this, I'm not able to be consistent. I don't want to be reneging on the commitment of my actions. He also suggests making an annual accounting, which is what we talked about over here. He talks about keeping track of what stock given to include it in the meiser. So what happens is one can have, let's say, some people just keep in their wallet a certain amount that they're going to distribute as they go along, or they have certain amounts they give to funds which they distribute coupons for. One should make sure that one's keeping track, so that can be included in one's cheshbon of meiser as well. If there's more meiser than the money given out, he says give it out immediately unless there's no recipient at hand. You're not just going to throw money away, but you want to make sure to empty your account by the end of the year. And if there's more money given out than meiser, you can put it back for next year's budget as well. So you can push over, you can roll it over to the next year as well. So just I think that the outcome of this, just sort of having looked at this, is treated very seriously. There's a lot of detail given to this, and it's a similar way that there's a lot of detail given to one's taxation and one's charity donations. There's a lot of details that are given to one's Masik Sofim. And again, coming to the realization that it's not all or nothing. This is we're all on the trajectory upwards towards something which is very meaningful. And Be'ezrat Hashem, as HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, if we do our share, God willing, Hashem should do His share to enable us to be His agents in this. And we close this section with the Rambam's famous words, and he says, "May Olam," says the Rambam, "forever, loy ra'inu, v'loy shamanu b'kal Yisrael, she'en laim kupa shel tzedaka." He says, look what Israel do. Look what Jews do for each other. Look how many social nets. Look how much care they have in society. We have so much to be proud of. And yet at the same time as being proud, there's so much more to be done. And that's the space that we live in. Rabbi Isa, thank you so much for taking the time. Have a wonderful, meaningful day. And next week we are doing Seder in the Seder. We're getting ready for this Seder.